This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, more uncertainty over the death of a top North Korean official. Legendary American comedian Bill Cosby faces sexual assault charges.
People feel so violated in a way, if the charges are true, that he was such a respected figure and a role model, especially for young African American young people.
Seaborne arrivals in Europe top 1 million. An American rock band's lead singer and guitarist goes solo. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. North Korea's announcement that one of the closest aides to leader Kim Jong-un died in a car crash is setting off a wave of speculation about the cause of the mysterious incident. North Korean media have released few details about Tuesday's crash that killed 73-year-old Kim Jong-gun, a veteran diplomat who led Pyongyang's negotiations with South Korea since the era of former leader Kim Jong-il. A state funeral is scheduled today. Steve Miller is a Seoul-based American journalist and host of the Asia News Weekly podcast. He visited our studios here in Washington and sat down with my colleague Michael Lippin, who asked him what he makes of Kim Jong-gun's sudden demise.
I think anytime you have a death of a high-ranking North Korean official, the tendency really is to always wonder if it was some sort of culling or if it was a natural event. Everyone that I know and have spoken to about this uses the term accident in air quotes. And the sad thing is that when things happen inside North Korea, we really don't know what happened. It's wintertime there. It could, in fact, be an accident. The fact that the KCNA, the North Korean Central News Agency, isn't releasing any details doesn't really tell us a lot. And it's somewhat irresponsible to interject some assumptions into the case. So it's sad that this could hamper North-South Korean relations because he is a high-ranking official.
I was just going to ask you, what is so significant about this official who died?
Well, he was one of the leaders of the North contingent that kind of solidified this latest round of agreements between North and South Korea in August after the landmine incident. So they will have to find someone else that can work positively with South Korea to address any cross-border concerns in the future, and who knows who that will be and what kind of working relationship that will have with the Ministry of Unification in Seoul.
Another big issue on the Korean Peninsula this past week has been South Korea and Japan agreeing to resolve their dispute about comfort women. So what struck you as especially interesting about this deal?
Well, I think the language of the agreement was particularly striking. When you look at this agreement and compare it to the 1965 bilateral relations, the Treaty for Normalization that Park's father, Park Chan-hee, signed in 1965.
And Park is the South Korean president.
Correct. Her father was the military dictator at the time. The language is starkly similar. I mean, there was an onage of responsibility. In this latest agreement, Japan acknowledges responsibility but doesn't take legal responsibility, and that's been one of the main points of contention. Abe expresses a new wave, a new round of apology and remorse, but it really doesn't say it's from him directly. It's his personal feeling. And those two things have been really the litmus test for the survivors to really accept final closure.
And why aren't they accepting? It doesn't seem that they're accepting Japan's expression of remorse this time.
Oh, and they haven't. The House of Sharing, which is the facility where many of the comfort women survivors live, have put out a statement saying that they feel that this negotiation is a humiliating fact on the part of the Seoul government. Many have come out and said that when or if the 1 billion yen fund is established in Seoul, that they will not partake in that, and they really don't consider the matter closed.
That's the compensation that Japan's offering.
Well, it's not compensation. It is a medical and support fund. It's not direct compensation for the atrocities committed, and that's a very important distinction to make.
Steve Miller, a Seoul-based American journalist, host and producer of the Asia News Weekly podcast, talking with International Edition's Michael Lippin. There is online reaction to the death of the North Korean official Kim Jong-gun. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here with details. Hi, G.
Hello, Ray.
What's the general sentiment to the top news?
Ray, Steve was right on the money when he said many experts and journalists are using the words car accident in air quotes when it comes to citing the reason for the death. It's quite hard, if not flat out impossible, to verify any news coming out of North Korea. For example, with trade figures, we can sometimes cross-reference Beijing's reports. With nuclear developments, we can refer to satellite images, but domestic politics is an entirely different story. So let's just say this tweet from the Financial Times reflects a general sentiment among the international media outlets. It reads like this: if you're a top comrade of North Korea's Kim Jong-un, perhaps you better watch out. As for experts, former intelligence officer Sumi Terry sent out this tweet: I'm relieved to see North Korea returning to its more traditional method of purging elites, a quote-unquote car crash. Obviously, this is a very sarcastic tweet, and she's referring to the fact that the recent purging of high-level officials in the country had been a bit more gruesome. Terry's on Twitter, at Sumi Terry. She served as a CIA analyst before joining Columbia University as senior research scholar.
I see. And what about some readers' comments?
Well, for that, let's go to our own VOA News website. We have an article titled Pyongyang Top Aide to North Korean Leader Killed in Car Crash, citing the communist country's state-run news agency, KCNA. Under the article, a reader with the last name Canfield wrote this comment: top North Korean officials have a history of leaving office via car crashes. Interesting, since there are very few cars on the road. So there are still many questions unanswered. Ray?
Yeah, there certainly are. Thanks for the update, G. You can follow her on Twitter at G Abby Lee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. She also tweets for International Edition at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition. Iraqi forces trying to clear the provincial capital of Ramadi after seizing the city from Islamic State militants are meeting with heavier resistance than first anticipated. U.S. military officials say Iraqi forces were encountering pockets of resistance and sporadic attacks, indicating a larger presence. Staying on offense has been difficult for the Islamic State recently, having lost control of Ramadi, giving up control of the vital Tishrin Dam in northern Syria to a U.S.-backed alliance of Kurdish and Arab rebels, and losing 10 leadership figures to coalition airstrikes in the past month. Indiana University regional analyst Abdul Qadir Sino told International Edition's Victor Beatty he agrees the Islamic State leadership is being decimated, but all 10 are what he calls mid-level or mid-tier leaders who can easily be replaced.
They get replaced, and it is damaging for them to lose those operatives. And they have lost most more important people before, too, especially people in charge of their finances and some of their organizers. And they do replace them. Now, whether those who replace them are better or worse than they operationally is open to question, because we don't really know who is replacing them.
A number of them have been identified as having lived in Europe and have been radicalized on the internet. This is a big problem.
Well, it is a big problem, and it reflects the existing tensions in Europe. Those people would not have been susceptible to be recruited by IS if they did not feel alienated in their own countries. Europe has a big problem.
How can they address it?
What they're doing right now is the opposite of what they need to do. What they're doing right now is to increase policing, inclusive policing, into Muslim areas, into mosques, into institutions, when in fact they need to help those youth integrate, to become part of society. It's a long-term process, but that's the only way to go in Europe. And they're not doing it right.
If they were able to successfully do this, would this limit the impact that Islamic State is having?
Of course. And we have the evidence right here. All you have to do is to compare the recruitment of the Islamic State in Europe and North America. Even though a few people in North America have been attracted to their message, they are a tiny minority. It all depends on whether they feel welcome and integrated. In Canada, very, very, very few, if any, are attracted to it. In the United States, a little bit more. In Europe, where Muslims are most marginalized, they're much more attracted to it.
Given this announcement by the Pentagon, coupled with the fall of Ramadi in Iraq and some territory lost by IS in northern Syria, has Islamic State peaked or is it still a major threat?
It has already peaked, but however, it still has the ability to fight and to retaliate. All this may accelerate and it may reach its demise in the next 2 years. On the other hand, a lot can happen over time. The Iraqi army is not ready yet. Now that they occupied Ramadi, they have cut the supply lines to Fallujah. But Mosul is a larger city. They have enough forces probably still to defend it. If for some reason they panic and people start to desert, then everything would get accelerated and then they would be defeated much more quickly.
Indiana University regional analyst Abdul Qadir Sino also warns the effect of increased civilian casualties in Syria since the Russian air campaign began September 30th will only radicalize the very groups the international community is trying to encourage to participate in peace talks with Damascus. He spoke with International Edition's Victor Beatty. One of America's most famous comedians was charged Wednesday with sexually assaulting a woman in 2004 after allegedly giving her wine and pills that left her unable to fight back. 78-year-old Bill Cosby was charged in a Pennsylvania courthouse outside Philadelphia with aggravated indecent assault, a felony that could result in 10 years in prison and a $25,000 fine if he is convicted. Cosby did not enter a plea. He was freed on $1 million bail and said nothing to reporters shouting questions as he entered and left the courthouse. The case involves Andrea Constand, a former basketball team manager at Temple University in Philadelphia, Cosby's alma mater. Constand settled a civil suit against Cosby in 2006. More than 50 women say Cosby sexually assaulted them in incidents dating back to the 1960s when he first emerged as a comedy star. Cosby and his lawyers have consistently denied charges of sexual misconduct. International Edition Sarah Williams spoke with VOA Los Angeles correspondent Michael Sullivan about the case.
Mike, these charges seem to sort of took everybody a bit by surprise. But looking at Cosby's career, he really has a very unique place in Hollywood.
Well, he does, and that's why people feel so violated in a way, if the charges are true, that he was such a respected figure and a role model, especially for young African-American young people. And beyond that, it wasn't something that was thrust upon him, as it is with many sports stars or others. In his case, he actively promoted that, and he acted as a kind of mentor for young people. And as one Hollywood journalist told me, he has a reputation among journalists as being a bit of a scold, a kind of moralistic. And so he set himself up really with his attitude and his approach and his role in American culture for, you know, charges of hypocrisy once these allegations came out. Of course, we don't know if they're true, but there are so many of them now that people, you know, I think the assumption is where there's smoke, there's fire. There must be something to this.
He spoke, I think, quite a bit about young African-American men. I think he took many of them to task for the way they dressed, for he said he felt that they didn't speak very good English. And certainly Cosby himself, though, has had a very lengthy career in Hollywood. I believe he was one of the first black actors to have regular parts on television, and he's had an extraordinarily successful career.
Well, he has. I mean, as I was growing up, he was in a light spy series, and he was one of the first African-American actors in a major network role, and he was simultaneously a stand-up comic. And he was extremely popular. I mean, I had friends who had memorized some of his dialogues and would recite them. He was a very popular guy, and that was even before he got into some of the, you know, that came out of his stand-up routines, his series on TV where he was the father of a family called the Huxtables on network TV for years, and was a kind of role model as an affluent African-American patriarch, and with cartoons, with characters like Fat Albert, who was a character he invented for his stand-up routines. And again, he was just... People have just known him for several generations as this prominent and very entertaining figure who also has a doctorate. He earned a doctorate in education. And as somebody who just played this mentoring role inside, and especially, for, as you say, for young Black people.
And it should be said, Cosby is now 78 years old. This is coming to him at the end of his life, towards the end of his life. And even though this particular case involves one woman, there are so many reports out there.
Well, there are. And, you know, he had people who were defending him. But first, as these allegations were coming out, and they've been, you know, there have been allegations for years, but they suddenly, there were just a large number of women, and there have been dozens in total, a large number seemed to come out one after another, effectively saying, well, I've kept quiet, but I'm going to break the silence because others are doing it, and I will as well. I mean, these women say they were traumatized or something they tried to forget about. They didn't want to be associated, you know, have their name associated with a scandal like this. But there have just been so many that he lost most of the support that he had among others in Hollywood. At a certain point, others just sort of kept quiet because, again, the feeling was that with so many allegations, could all these women be lying? And I think that's what, you know, if you ask a typical American today, that's what they would say. There probably is something to some of these allegations.
VOA Los Angeles correspondent Mike O'Sullivan speaking with my colleague Sarah Williams. The UN Refugee Agency reports more than 1 million refugees and migrants have reached Europe by sea this year, with 80% of this record number landing on small, overcrowded Greek islands. The latest figures, which account for only migration by sea, mark an increase in the number of migrants reaching Europe by sea and land. Lisa Schlein has details.
The UN Refugee Agency says refugees fleeing war and persecution are paying a heavy price in their desperation to find a safe haven. It reports 3,735 people have lost their lives this year, making the dangerous Mediterranean Sea crossing. This translates to an average of 10 deaths or missing persons every day. The UNHCR reports the total number of seaborne refugees this year is nearly five times higher than last, when just over 200,000 arrived in Europe, making this the biggest refugee crisis in Europe since World War II. UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards says between 2,000 and 3,000 people, most of them Syrians, continue to arrive by boats on the islands of the Aegean every day, despite the freezing cold temperatures and raging seas. He tells VOA the refugees fleeing conflicts in their countries take to the sea because most land routes into Europe are blocked.
There are restrictions at the border. We have countries that have erected fences along borders, land borders, and sea really remains the main viable option for those people. Unfortunately, what it means, though, is that smuggling is profiting in a major way. It means that people are drowning. It means that the systems for making this regular movement of people aren't yet in place.
Edwards notes Europe's migration crisis reflects what he calls an era of record-breaking forcible displacement. A recent UNHCR report finds the number of people who are refugees or internally displaced because of conflict now exceeds more than 60 million. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Coming up, a rocker goes solo. This is VOA.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOAnews.com.
Visit VOAnews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition. Plants tell time. Their internal biological clock tells them when to flower, fruit, and go to seed. That circadian rhythm may help breeders develop crops to feed a growing population in a warmer world. VOA's Roseanne Skirbel explains.
Biologist Rob McClung at Dartmouth College wants to solve this problem.
By 2050, it's estimated we have to increase world food supply by about 50% to 60%. And we're worried that the things that we've done to increase agricultural productivity may be becoming exhausted.
To find new ways to increase productivity, McClung looked at plants' circadian rhythm, the process all living things use to synchronize their internal biological clocks with the external world.
So the question we wanted to ask, is there natural variation? Are there different genes in crop plants that affect circadian period?
The answer is yes. Writing in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, McClung identifies a gene called Giantia in a common species of field mustard, a plant related to turnips, cabbage, and other vegetables. The gene speeds up or slows down its circadian rhythm depending on which version of Giantia is expressed. That affects when the plant flowers and how quickly the seedlings develop. McClung says it also influences important traits like resistance to extreme cold and high salt.
And we want to be able to predict if you do this to the clock, you will do this to crop yield. And so hopefully what we can do now that we know this is we've given breeders a molecular tool to try and, for example, introduce increased salt tolerance or increased cold tolerance into a crop plant that we're actually cultivating.
McClung says rather than waiting for plants to mature to measure the yield, breeders could look at very young seedlings and predict the outcome.
And so given that the plant clock is one of the ways, one of the major ways that the plant tries to synchronize itself with its environment, we think that by manipulating the plant clock, we will be able to make plants that are better in tune with their environment and able to perform more effectively.
McClung says developing new ways to boost crop yields is critical. Experts say the expected growth in the production of the world's major food crops, corn, rice, wheat, and soybeans, would not be enough to sustain a global population expected to reach 9.5 billion by 2050. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Guitarist and singer Billy Gibbons is best known for his work with the band ZZ Top. But now Gibbons is out with his first solo album. The CD has an Afro-Cuban flavor that reaches back to Gibbons' childhood. International Edition's David Byrd gives it a listen.
There's no mistaking Billy Gibbons' guitar work. The Rock and Roll Hall of Famer's fronting of ZZ Top has earned the Texas trio multiple gold and platinum albums in more than 40 years together. But now Gibbons has released his first solo album, Perfecto Mundo, which is marked by Afro-Cuban rhythms and a new band called the BFGs. Gibbons says that the process began with a phone call inviting him to perform without bandmates Dusty Hill and Frank Beard at the Havana Jazz Festival.
It seemed interesting until we put that word jazz in the figure, and I said, well, I don't know jazz. I know I can play some blues, I can play some rock. That other thing is well outside. However, who would want to pass up an opportunity to go to Cuba? Very few.
Gibbons called his friend and band leader Chino Ponce, who is from Havana. Ponce liked what he heard, and Perfecto Mundo began to take shape. Turns out Latin music is something that Billy Gibbons is familiar with after his father, himself a band leader, sent Billy to study with legendary Puerto Rican percussionist Tito Puente in 1962.
I was 13. I just turned 13 and showed up did not have a care in the world. And fortunately, Tito Puente is one of these gifted individuals that during his lifetime, he shared a genuine passion that made everything uplifted. And when he heard me hitting this and hitting that, he said, okay, you got it. He said, now we're going to place it. And that was the magic.
Gibbons has assembled a band that includes multiple percussionists, an organist, a pianist, a bassist, and, of course, Billy on guitar. Gibbons says the recording process felt more like a jam session.
It's basically a private club with no time clock running and no real thought of this, let's make a record. We were just making experiments in music that just happened to have an Afro-Cuban twist.
I want to tell you a story. Every man ought to know.
Billy Gibbons and the BFGs have released the first single off the new album, a cover of Roy Head's 1965 hit, Treat Her Right. They plan to tour in support of the album, including stops in Havana, Cuba, until February. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
That'll do it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, features, videos, and podcasts on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One thing is for certain. As our collective populations grow, so will our need for energy. And just as surely, as we ramp up energy production, wherever possible, we must turn to production that is clean and sustainable. Today's global population is about 7.3 billion people. Of these, millions are underserved, and about 1 billion have no access at all to electricity. So, given that the population will expand to some 9 billion by the year 2050, in order to accommodate the needs of another 3 billion people, our energy output will need to increase by at least 80%. Even in the short term, the numbers are staggering. As Undersecretary for Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment, Catherine Novelli, said recently, in just the next 15 years, we can expect the world will add more than 5,500 gigawatts of electricity capacity. This is the equivalent of adding all the power generation that exists in the world today. At the same time, we need to also reduce our greenhouse gas emissions in the energy sector by 60% to 80% to address global climate change. One of the most promising technological advances in energy production is distributed energy systems, including off-grid solutions, such as power generators and solar panels, said Undersecretary Novelli. And because low-carbon technologies, such as solar panels, will be easier to acquire and cheaper to run than fossil fuel technologies, she said, the vast majority of those new connections will come from renewable energy sources. The United States has recently committed to providing access to off-grid clean energy products and services to more than 500 million people by 2020. This includes a $75 million loan guarantee from USAID's Power Africa program to scale up off-grid renewable investments in sub-Saharan Africa. $20 million in loans from the Overseas Private Investment Corporation for supporting residential solar in Kenya and Nigeria. And $46 million from the Millennial Challenge Corporation for off-grid electrification in Benin. When it comes to energy, our goal is to ensure access to affordable, reliable, sustainable, clean energy for all by 2030.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.